Hello, my name's Dave Emery. This is For the Record program number 388, titled Between a Rock and a Hard Place, Part 5. This is being recorded on November 25th of the year 2002. I've been asked many times to begin slightly off topic. This is not about a rock. I guess one could say this is the hard place. People have asked me many times since shortly before the election what I thought about the death of Paul Wellstone. I think that about everything that I would say was said in an article that appeared on the front page of the New York Times on Wednesday, November 20th of 2002. This article by John Tierney is about Senator Robert C. Byrd, the eldest Democratic senator in the Senate, and he has been waxing fairly eloquent about certain things. And for once, I guess you could say on For the Record, I will simply ask you to read between the lines. Again, those lines from the New York Times of Wednesday, November 20th of 2002. John Tierney, Dateline, Washington, November 19th. Headline, Byrd at 85 fills the forum with Romans and wrath, and it reads in part as follows. As his colleagues hurriedly tried to give the president a domestic security bill, Senator Robert C. Byrd took the floor this morning to tell them of a truly great, unquote, senator from the first century A.D. named Helvidius Priscus. On one day, this Roman was met outside the Senate by the Emperor Vespasian, who threatened to execute him if he spoke too freely. Quote, and so both did their parts, unquote, Mr. Byrd said. Helvidius Priscus spoke his mind. The Emperor Vespasian killed him. In this effeminate age, it is instructive to read of courage. There are members of the U.S. Senate and House who are terrified, apparently, if the President of the United States tells them, urges them, to vote a certain way that may be against their belief. Unquote. Skipping down, speaking of the domestic security bill which he opposed, this monstrosity, Mr. Byrd has been calling the bill, repeatedly lifting its 484 pages above his head with trembling hands and flinging them down on his desk with the fury of Moses smashing the tablets. There is dissent directly on the matter of Iraq from within the national security establishment. Well, that was the focal point of an article by David Ignatius, or an op-ed column, I should say, by David Ignatius in the Washington Post of November 1st of 2002, titled Doubt in the Ranks. It reads in part as follows. Mobilizing the United States for war is hard enough, but it becomes truly difficult when the State Department, the Pentagon brass, and the intelligence agencies are all, for somewhat different reasons, expressing doubts about the mission. Congress is running scared on Iraq for fear of seeming unpatriotic on the eve of the midterm elections. But that political silence has masked the increasingly vocal grumbling throughout the Washington bureaucracy. Skipping down, speaking of that grumbling, Washington's dissent extends further into the ranks of the military. The extent of Pentagon mistrust of the leading Iraq hawk, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, was revealed in a remarkable article last month by Vernon Loeb and Thomas E. Ricks of the Post. They reported that military anger over Rumsfeld's frequently abusive and indecisive, unquote, style was, again quoting, influencing the Pentagon's internal debate over a possible invasion of Iraq, with some officers questioning whether their concerns about the dangers of urban warfare and other aspects of a potential conflict are being sufficiently weighed, unquote. Another skeptical bureaucracy is the Central Intelligence Agency. At a time when the CIA is waging a global anti-terrorism war against Al-Qaeda, the Iraq talk strikes many intelligence officers as a dangerous distraction. CIA analysts fear that in its eagerness to find an Iraqi smoking gun, unquote, the Bush administration may be cooking the intelligence, that is, implying connections between Al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein that have not been established. Rank-and-file CIA officers don't want to do this war, unquote, says one former agency official of his former colleagues. They fear, in part, that an Iraq war will jeopardize the liaison relationships with other intelligence services that are crucial in fighting al-Qaeda. If President Bush is going to lead the country into battle, he needs to begin by convincing his own national security bureaucracy the effects of Iraq like Vietnam could last a generation. It's crucial to get it right and to have a united country that will stay the course behind the president even when things turn nasty and optimistic assumptions prove wrong. One of the most poignant aspects of Vietnam was that Lyndon Johnson was pushed into a war he suspected would go badly. The pressure to fight came from hawks in the Pentagon, the intelligence agencies, and the State Department. Bush won't have that excuse. He may choose war, but if he does so today, it'll be despite widespread, if largely silent, dissent. That again from the Washington Post of November 1st of 2002. Among the places, among the prestigious military milieu, plural, in which dissent has become evident, is in, among other places, or has been in, among other places, in the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey. That is, again, among the most important military academies in the world, and I think the description that follows will suffice to give a good synoptic account of that institution for those who may be unfamiliar with it. The focal point of this particular column by Robert Collier in his Global California column in the San Francisco Chronicle, the focal point of this particular column is not only former Navy Secretary James Webb, himself a decorated combat veteran, Marine officer from Vietnam, or who served in Vietnam, also a gentleman whose name I believe is pronounced Arquilla, A-R-Q-U-I-L-L-A. I may be mispronouncing that. If so, apologies to Mr. Arquilla or Arquia. I've never heard his name pronounced aloud. So Arquilla or Arquia. I'll call, say, Arquilla. But again, that's a guess, so apologies if I'm mispronouncing that. Anyway, the San Francisco Chronicle of November 10th of 2002, Robert Collier's Global California column titled, At Navy School in Monterey, Voices of Skepticism About Iraq. It reads, when former Secretary of the Navy James Webb gave a speech last Thursday at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey slamming the Bush administration's threatened war with Iraq, an outsider might have expected the officers assembled there to give him a frosty reception. In fact, the opposite occurred. The respectful, admiring welcome he received gave an unusual, somewhat counterintuitive glimpse into the often closed world of the U.S. military. Among the Naval Postgraduate School students and faculty, at least, it seems that independent critical thinking is alive and well. Granted, Webb is no outsider. A much decorated former Marine officer, he became Assistant Defense Secretary and Secretary of the Navy during the Reagan administration, quitting the latter job in 1988 to protest budget cutbacks in the Navy's fleet expansion program. In recent months, Webb has been a vocal critic of the Bush administration's Iraq policy, calling it, in an op-ed in the Washington Post, a distraction from the fight against al-Qaeda. But in his introduction before a packed auditorium, the school superintendent, Rear Admiral David Ellison, calling Webb a military hero and a dedicated public servant, unquote. Webb took the baton and ran with it, warning that a war in Iraq and a possible long-term occupation of the country would be a critical mistake. Quote, we should not occupy territory in Iraq, he said. Do you really want the United States on the ground in that region for a generation, unquote? I don't think Iraq is that much of a threat, said Webb, an opinion rarely heard among current or former Reagan administration officials. But Webb recalled proudly that as Navy Secretary in 1987, quote, I was the only one in the Reagan administration who opposed the tilt toward Iraq in the war with Iran, unquote, referring to the U.S. sharing of intelligence, and arms with Saddam Hussein's forces. By the way, the elder George Bush and Rumsfeld participated in that particular operation, or in the arming of Iraq, the Iraq Aid operation. It was run by the elder Bush. Continuing. The reaction at Monterey to Webb's speech might have surprised Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, who has led the administration's charge in Iraq. Quote, "His reputation may be controversial, but a lot of things he said we tend to agree with," said Navy Lieutenant Commander Paul Tanks, a graduate student in Space Systems Operations. The Naval Postgraduate School, at least in civilian circles, does not have the name recognition of military institutions like West Point, but it is a premier school for the U.S. Armed Services, giving master's and Ph.D. degrees to mid-level officers of the Navy and other branches. About one quarter of its student body is foreign, from the armed forces of 45 different nations. Some departments, such as meteorology and computer science, rank with the best of U.S. civilian universities. "The military is not monolithic," said John Arquia, a professor of defense analysis who was in the audience Thursday, again quoting, "These are military officers. They're very sensible people, and Webb is a very, very thoughtful guy," unquote. Arquia, like Webb, is one of the military's critical thinkers, an oft-quoted expert on what he calls network theory, unquote, studying decentralized organizations like Al-Qaeda. Quote, "Iraq is a terrible detour from what we ought to be doing," Arquia said, again quoting, "The real threat is from the Al-Qaeda network. Saddam is a minimal threat to us. He knows that if he uses any of his weapons of mass destruction against us or our allies, we're going to nuke him into glass. But if Al-Qaeda uses them, what are we going to retaliate against? Whom do we target?" Unquote. Arquia explained that many students agree with Webb. Military officers, he said, are far from the hard-line, uncritical thinkers that most civilians think they are. Quote, "Most of my students are in special operations. They want to be challenged. They are off-design thinkers by nature," Arquia said, again quoting. "Overall, military officers have a great openness of mind. There's a great capacity for innovative thinking. They've seen a lot. They've done a lot. They come here at mid-career. Now, we're getting many who are rotating out of Afghanistan. This isn't like four-star generals who were just thinking how to protect their conventional force structures," unquote. And again, noting the caliber of some of the dissent within the ranks of the national security establishment there, certainly these are not individuals who could be accused either of sort of being shrinking violet liberals or doves, nor could they be accused of being ignorant of the hands-on military situation as such. Let me voice my previous analysis, and this will seem nuts, but that this actually represents the entire struggle that has ensued with the Bush administration actually represents a continuation of the Second World War, metamorphosing into a third, and with the Underground Reich having precipitated hostilities among a mutual combatants who will ultimately, adversaries, sort of best of enemies, who will ultimately wind up becoming each other's mutual executioners to the betterment, ultimately, of the Underground Reich. Now, I would suggest just that some of the models for this admittedly complex scenario, from a structural standpoint, for the record, 372, that is streaming at WFMU.org/Dave Emery. There is a detailed annotated description at www.spitfirelist.com. Again, spitfirelist.com in the For the Record section. Anyway, some of the theoretical or some of the strategic considerations that may very well be underlying not only some of the considerations that I have, and again, I've said in a number of programs, and as I will discuss again in future broadcasts, I believe that the attacks of 9/11 and the continuation of this particular struggle could be said to have begun, or the final phase to have begun, with what one might call the Battle of Menwith Hill. This basically the German/Underground Reich/EU effort at undermining not only the Men With Hill listening station, but also the Associated Echelon network, leaving aside some of the very real issues in consideration with both. That constituted, as I said, first in late 1998. From a military strategic analytical standpoint, it was something akin, I said, to the attack on Pearl Harbor. So the Battle of Men With Hill could be said to have precipitated the struggle. And for reference reading, and this is not to be cute, but a couple of conspiracy books might be useful to reflect on. Again, some of the things that I talk about. One is the strategy, or basically the Art of War by Sun Tzu, and the other is The Prince by Niccolo Machiavelli. Both books should be read carefully. Also, On War by Karl von Clausewitz. So for people that might be inclined to say, well, I don't believe in conspiracy theories, again, read The Art of War by Sun Tzu, The Prince by Niccolo Machiavelli, and On War by Karl von Clausewitz, and then we will speak at some length and in detail. The San Francisco Examiner of Monday, November 18th of 2002, underlined one of the strategic considerations that is something that may very well be on the minds of some of the military officers who have objected to the Bush administration's policy. This is an AP story by Matt Kelly of Stateline, Washington, headlined Iraq Chem Threat. It reads, Iraqi scientists know how to make chemical weapons that can penetrate military protective clothing, and Iraq imported up to 25 metric tons last month of a powder that is crucial in, that is a crucial ingredient to such, quote, dusty weapons, unquote. Iraq told the United Nations that powder was destined for a pharmaceutical company that a former weapons inspector says was ordered by President Saddam Hussein before the 1991 Persian Gulf War to work on chemical and biological weapons. The powder, sold under the brand name Aerosil, has particles so small that when coated with deadly poisons, can pass through the tiniest gaps in protective suits. And again, note this particular powder, Aerosil. It comes from Germany. We're going to talk about the manufacture of that, this to be reflected on against the background of the underground. Right, continuing, experts inside and outside the U.S. government say they're not certain Iraq has dusty chemical weapons. Declassified U.S. intelligence documents say Iraq produced a dusty form of the blister agent mustard gas in the 1980s and used it during its eight-year war with Iran. If Iraq made and used a powdered form of its deadliest nerve agent, VX, it could kill U.S. troops dressed in full protective gear, according to a 1990 Defense Intelligence Agency assessment. Although the military's protective suits have been improved since then, experts say dusty weapons could penetrate the new suits. Pentagon officials refused to discuss the permeability of the new suits or whether Iraq had weapons that could pass through them. Such information is classified, they said. The 1990 DIA document said soldiers could protect themselves by throwing rain ponchos over their chemical suits, which would reduce the fatality risk to near zero. One expert wrote later, quote, one gets the sense that this was recommended in the face of few other options, unquote. The researcher Eric Crotty of the private Center for Nonproliferation Studies says dusty VX would be a serious danger to U.S. troops. VX is so toxic that, in its liquid form, a drop on the skin can kill within minutes. The effects of dusty VX, depending on how it gets into the body, would be somewhat faster, unquote, Crotty said, again quoting, it's certainly much more injurious and much more of a severe threat, unquote. Dusty chemical weapons are formed by mixing a liquid chemical agent with a fine powder to coat the powder's tiny particles with a deadly poison. The particles' small size allows them to pass through the fabric of a protective suit and any tiny gaps around the seal of a gas mask. The latest U.S. military protective suits have a layer of charcoal in the fabric to trap any poisons that might penetrate the outer covering, but particles small enough could pass through even the charcoal layer. The closest analogy is no matter what happens, when you go to the beach, you still get sand in your shorts, Crotty said. The poisonous powder also would settle in the tiniest nooks and crannies of buildings and equipment, making decontamination extremely difficult. VX, in its liquid form, already is a decontamination challenge. The sticky poison is persistent and cannot be neutralized easily with substances such as bleach. Even if dusty chemical weapons cause no U.S. casualties, they could force American soldiers to work in clumsy protective gear, decontaminate their equipment, and avoid contaminated areas, giving Iraqi soldiers time to mount defenses. Aerosil also, now that is a product exclusively from Germany. Aerosol has also basically been, has basically been the focal point of an article in the Washington Post on October 28th of 2002. It's headlined, FBI's Theory on Anthrax is Doubted. It's by Guy Gugliotta and Gary Matsumoto, M-A-T-U-S-M-O-T-O, of the Washington Post staff. And it's headlined, basically subheaded, I should say, headlined again, FBI's Theory on Anthrax is Doubted, subheaded, Attacks Not Likely the Work of One Person, experts say. The lead paragraph, a significant number of scientists and biological warfare experts are expressing skepticism about the FBI's view that a single disgruntled American scientist prepared the spores and mailed the deadly anthrax letters that killed five people last year. These sources say that making a weaponized aerosol of such sophistication and virulence would require scientific knowledge, technical competence, access to expensive equipment, and safety know-how that are probably beyond the capabilities of an individual. And skipping down in that article, according to William C. Patrick III, the former chief officer of development for the U.S. Army's now defunct bioweapons program, U.S. government scientists made biological agents using spray dryers, but did not spray dry anthrax. Fumed silica grains are between 0.012 and 0.300 of a micron in size and will readily adhere to the surface of any larger particle, such as an anthrax spore. By the way, this is what the anthrax spores that were sent to Daschle and Patrick Leahy and to members of the media, this is what they were. Basically, this is the medium that was used to communicate it. Beginning again, coated particles will easily disperse because the grains act as tiny, quote, ball bearings, unquote, enabling the larger bits to skid past one another. Under an electron microscope, fumed silica would look like cotton balls strung together into strands that branch out in every direction. Their extremely small size gives them an aerodynamic quality, and their high surface area allows them to readily trap moisture, acting as a natural desiccant. Again, quoting, if you package this stuff in a container, it would float out, and it's highly dispersible and messy to deal with, said C. Jeffrey Prinker, a University of New Mexico chemical engineer and a senior scientist at the Sandia National Laboratories. Moreover, Brinker added, simply by shaking the particles in a jar, they acquire an electric charge, which causes them to repel one another and not clump together. A few passes through a mail sorting machine would create the same effect. The particles would float, but they would remain separated. This concept of using of something that would serve as a desiccant and a carrier at the same time is new, unquote, said Harvard University chemical engineer David Edwards, again quoting, it's a diabolically brilliant idea, unquote. Fumed silica has myriad uses, mostly as a thickening agent in products including ceramics, house paint, toothpaste, and cosmetics. It is not widely known as an aerosol additive. Quote, if you're going to put it into the lung, there has to be a mechanism to clear it, otherwise you just fill up somebody's lung with silica after repeated dosing, said Dalby of the aerosol lab. The anthrax mailer, he noted, obviously wasn't worried about giving his victims silicosis. Such fumed silicas are extremely difficult to make, but at least two, Aerosil and Cabasil, are readily available and sold commercially in bulk. Freudian slip there, excuse me. Either product, in theory, could be used to coat anthrax spores. Aerosil is based in Germany and Cabasil in Boston. And note that it was Aerosil that was the focal point of this multi-ton shipment into Iraq. Now, Aerosil is manufactured by a company that is basically a subsidiary of Degussa. And Degussa, formerly of IG Farben, is now getting independence from the E.ON company, one of the diversified conglomerates, formerly a power company, still involved in the power business in Germany. So again, the sole manufacturer of Cabasil, or Aerosil, excuse me, not Cabasil, but Aerosil, that is one of the agents that may have been used in the anthrax attacks, a very sophisticated use of both a dispersing agent and a desiccant at the same time. The manufacturer of Aerosil, a multi-ton shipment of which went to Iraq, apparently, and something which could be used to make weapons that would penetrate the chemical protection suits that the troops may have. The sole manufacturer of that is a Degussa subsidiary called Aerosil and Silanes, or Silanes. I'm not sure how it's pronounced. S-I-L-A-N-E-S. That is a subsidiary, a business unit of Degussa. Degussa is the parent firm that made Zyklon B during the Second World War. It was at the time an IG Farben subsidiary, and like the other units that were sort of spun off from IG Farben, they have largely perpetuated their commercial structure, and in many cases some of the Third Reich alumni that sort of won them in fame during World War II. More importantly, those structures have continued to function in the post-war period. We've talked about Degussa in For the Record programs 87, 287, and 295, among others. It is interesting indeed. By the way, you can visit the website of Degussa.com, and you can visit information about Degussa, Aerosil, and Silanes, the manufacturer of Aerosil. Something to contemplate in that regard, and that concerns the broadcast during Ramadan of a television documentary based on the protocols of the Elders of Zion. The following op-ed column by Qais S. Saleh is called The Road to Imported Bigotry, and it reads in part, "The latest controversy to involve the Arab world concerns a TV program, A Rider Without a Horse, that started airing on November 5th, the first day of Ramadan, on several Arab satellite channels. The source of the controversy is that the program is partly based on the protocols of the Elders of Zion, the old forgery originating in Tsarist Russia." Skipping down. "The main reason why we as Arabs should reject this program and the text it uses is that it is an imported piece of anti-Semitic bigotry that was forged in one of the darkest chapters in European history. It has nothing to do with historical facts and, more importantly, with the Arab world's tolerant past, where Jews were an integrated minority living in harmony with Muslims, Christians, and other religious minorities." There will be a detailed annotated description in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website, spitfirelist.com. And sister station WFMU is archiving the programs at two real audio sites, wfmu.org/Dave Emery, and a longer website that it's a longer URL linked to both the other WFMU website and to the Spitfire website. That concludes For the Record program number 388, Between a Rock and a Hard Place, Part 5. This is being recorded on November 25th of the year 2002. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.